You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 614. However vast the darkness, we must apply our own light. Stanley Kubrick.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Film Convert Nitrate. Now, guys, I've been in post-production for close to 30 years, and I have never seen a plug-in for film conversion better than Film Convert Nitrate. It allows you to color correct and add just the right amount of film grain, film look to your projects. I've used Film Convert on my projects, like on my last feature film On the Corner of Ego and Desire, and so many other projects over the years. Film Convert realistically models the amount of grain required in each color and exposure level in your image. It is remarkable. Now, the plugins available for Premiere Pro, DaVinci Resolve, and Final Cut Pro. All you need to do is head over to filmconvert.com. That's filmconvert.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films. From predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them, the odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Well, guys, today on the show, we have returning champion, Mark Travis. Now, last time Mark was on the show, we discussed his Travis technique in directing, where you direct the character and not the actor, which is a fascinating conversation. I'll leave a link to that interview in the show notes. But in this episode, we brought Mark back to discuss the power of staging and how you can properly stage any scene and save not only the scene, but your film, and analyzing some of the great filmmakers of our time to see how they staged their films and tips and techniques on how you can do it on an indie budget. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Mark W. Travis. I'd like to welcome back to the show, returning champion, Mark W. Travis. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing great. I didn't expect returning champion.
You were in episode 154, very well received episode over the years, how to direct the character, not the actor, which was the Travis technique and all that stuff. And it was a fantastic conversation. It's almost 2 hours, if I remember. So the it was a long conversation about that, because it was just a unique way of a director approaching the craft. Mm-hmm. It was just completely different. But it's been a while. You're due back, sir. You're late. You should have been back years ago. But in this episode, I'm really going to focus on another area that you're really starting to change the game in, as well as staging. So before we even get into staging, can you tell everybody a little bit about yourself, where you come from, how you got into the business?
First of all, I'm a director, writer, actor, and all that in this business. How I got into this business, which is really important, and anything we're discussing, is I came into this world through theater. And it was when I was in college, I discovered theater and something clicked, and I started working a lot in theater and studying theater. And I went to Yale Drama School to study as a director in the MFA program. that's how I got into this business. And then somehow I ended up in Los Angeles and started studying film. The reason I mentioned the theater part is because my career has done a very, all by itself, an interesting shift, which I was not expecting many years ago. I was directing television. I directed my first feature film, which did not do well. And it was for a major studio known as Warner Brothers. And we could talk about that and why not to do what I did. But anyway, you know, work your first film with a major studio, if it doesn't do well, boy, you have a big albatross on your back. Anyway, that led me to where I am now, into teaching, ironically. And what I discovered is everything I've learned, everything I know, all the skills I've acquired, my teaching has done two things. First of all, it has given me a whole nother perspective in terms of the work I'm doing, teaching, consulting, coaching, and all that. But the important thing about teaching anything, especially a craft like filmmaking, is you'll get questions like, why did you do it this way? Or how do you do this? Or why do you do that? And you have to come up with an answer. Now, the thing is, most of what we do as directors, so much of what we do is by instinct, intuition. I'm going to put the camera here. Oh, I'm going to direct it this way. No, I want it in this location. But if someone asks you why, to explain to me why you're making that choice in terms of your film, you really have to think about what you have to do as a teacher is look at what you're doing and try to understand what you're doing and then be able to explain it to somebody else in such a way that they can understand, not necessarily that they have to do that, but they can understand why you're making those choices. So in terms of the staging, which we'll talk about today, staging in terms of storytelling is a very, very important aspect of it, whether it's theater or film. But we'll talk about theater for a second here or more. In theater, it's all you've got. You've got the play, you've got the cast, you've got the set, you've got the lights, you've got all that. Staging is your most powerful tool, and you have to stage the play somehow. You have to do something. What you don't have, so a lot of things you don't have in theater. You don't have a camera. You don't have multiple takes. You don't have editing. You don't have all those tools that we have and rely heavily on in filmmaking. So staging has to work. And you have to learn in theater, which I did, and I still direct theater, how can I focus the audience the way I want them to be? How can I highlight something? How can I stimulate the actors? How can I use this tool? I have to use this tool of staging to make the play work. So that's serious. So when I started teaching film directing, and again, we're looking at a scene, and many times I'd look at a scene that a student would bring in and I'd say, okay, this is good, but you know, the staging is off. Let me show you something. And I would show them something. They say, how did you do that? Suddenly the scene would change. Now I have to figure out why, after years of directing, why I'm making that choice, and how does it come to me? So this is a serious part of my work now, and my work now too, which we haven't discussed yet, Alex, but I will, happy to, is I am trying to very clearly in these coming years focus on a couple of things. One, understand what I do and why I do it and how it works and why it works. And the other is, and that's why I'm doing podcasts and a lot of online teaching, is to record all of it so it's there. It's a legacy project. So I can say, I've recorded this. I've stopped writing books because I can't write a book well enough that you can see what I'm doing. But right. I can record something. I can record a video. And so now a lot of my teaching, I'm using a lot of video and a lot of film clips so you can actually see the process and see the change. You have to see it. You can't just read about it. So that's where I am now. And I'm doing a lot of online seminars, workshops. I'm in the middle of one now, which is on staging, ironically, and which will finish up next week. I'm doing those in order for me to continue to do this exploration and then share all the ideas with other filmmakers around the world.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
Fantastic. I've always been fascinated with your teaching technique and what you've been doing. But since you brought it up, I need to go back and ask. Your first feature, or your feature that you did with Warners, which is called Going Under, if I'm not mistaken.
And that's what it did.
It went straight down to the bottom, sir. But the, I mean, the cast, I mean, you had Bill Pullman, you had Ned Beatty, and a bunch of other cast characters.
I had Roddy McDowell doing an impression of Mr. Rogers in the film. I mean, no, I had some amazing actors.
So when you went through that process, and this is, I always love digging into these kind of conversations and these stories because filmmakers don't understand. And yeah, it was the 90s and it's a different world than it was today and things like that. But a lot of the core lessons are still there. So you went there, you made your movie, it didn't do well. The town threw you into director's jail, basically. That's generally what happens, right? Especially when you
have problems. That's what happened. Exactly.
What was the budget? What was the budget of this, by the way?
It was around $9 million, which to them was pocket change.
So that's like a equivalent of maybe a $50 or $60 million studio movie today. Not dollar wise, but scope wise of what you were trying to do.
Scope wise, yes. And it's one of those, a little bit about that. We myself and the two writers were seeking to make it for $3 million. Independently, and Warner Brothers got interested, and that's a long story, which has something to do with Bronx Tale, of why they were interested, because I created Bronx Tale anyway, so they wanted to talk to me. But as soon as the student, they took it over as a independent project that they were just going to do a negative pickup on, and then Warner Brothers decided to produce it. They said, no, it's not going to be a negative. And that's when it went from $3 million suddenly to $9 million. And getting back to what you're talking about, did anything change? No, it just got more expensive. And all the vendors that we had already lined up to work on this project, suddenly their prices went up when it said Shocking. Warner Brothers.
Shocking.
And I go, I got more money, but I can't do any more. I can't do more with it. But I got more money to spend, but that's it.
Yeah, if you could turn off your dings and dongs, that'd be great.
Yep. So sorry about that. So what happened was it exploded financially, and it also exploded in terms of studio control.
The studio
at the same time
started to crawl up your butt.
Yep. Absolutely. And there are a lot of other stories. If you want to talk about them later, I can. It's a long, painful, beautiful but painful story. Yeah.
So and it's just a classic tale of what happens in the studio system, unless you're a big hitter and you're the 800 pound gorilla, or you can walk around like Ridley Scott and do whatever the hell you want.
That's right.
It's a different conversation when it's your first time out and you got a shot.
One little thing. I'll make this short.
Sure.
Bob Daly, who was head of Warner Brothers at the time, and when the film was finished, and he wanted to meet with me, and we had a very nice meeting. And I'm not going to get into all of this right now, but the internal politics of a major studio, once they're producing your film, you're part of that. And you're part of, and you get into the competition between executives, between them. It's like the world's most dysfunctional family. Mm-hmm. And all Bob Daly could say to me afterwards, he says, "I'm sorry, Mark, you were just at the wrong place at the wrong time." Had nothing to do with the film, the quality of the film. It had to do with the internal politics that was going on, the wars that were going on.
And I can only imagine what's going on at Warner Brothers again with Batgirl. They just shelved a $100 million finished film.
I know. Yeah. Extraordinary.
I mean, they'll dump it on HBO Max. I mean, how bad? They released Catwoman. Like what? I mean, how bad is Batgirl that they just, so you know the politics, you know how many people lost their jobs during that there's so much stuff going on inside the walls.
In fact, if they released it now, even just streaming, do you know how many people would want to see it?
Oh my God.
To see how, How bad is this, really?
Well, it was like Cats. I mean, Cats was so bad that it's the worst thing to happen to cats and dogs. But my favorite line.
That's great. I like that. That's good.
It was a Twitter review. I was like, oh, my God, that is amazing. I stopped 20 minutes in. I just couldn't go any farther in that movie. It was so, so bad. But I got to start to watch it. And the only reason I wanted to watch it was, how bad is this?
Yeah. And you found out. And that's good. And so it was what you expected or worse. And anyway, but that's so, you're right.
But that's the thing too with Batgirl is that you're right. If there's a reason why it's not being released, and it's politics, internal mm-hmm. politics is the only reason why it's not getting released, because there's value there. Even if it's a bad, look, Warner Brothers puts out bad movies. They've put out a ton of bad movies in the history of Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
So what made this one so special of how bad is it? It's insane. But anyway, that just wanted to kind of go under with you again, take you back to some of the worst times of your life and really relive them, sir.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
So
it got so bad that I ended up in the hospital. So there.
I know many directors who I've had panic attacks on set. Yeah. Oh, it's not a fun. It's not an easy job. No. Now, there's a question I wanted to ask you. You've talked about the four languages of cinema. What are the four languages of cinema?
Four languages. Well, first of all, there is the visual language, which is a whole nother subject, which is huge because it's a visual medium. So that's visual. And when I say language, is that you as the filmmaker are actually communicating with your audience through these four languages. Mm-hmm. So one is the visual, however you shoot it, the looks, the production design, the aesthetics, the CGI, whatever it is, there's that visual language. The second language is very clearly the dialogue, which is a language. It's usually in English, whatever, but that dialogue and how in the script and how in the final film you're using dialogue, how dialogue is communicating with the audience. Now, all four languages are communicating with the audience simultaneously. The third language is sound. Aside from dialogue, but it's sound, sound effects, music, and however you're using the element of audio and sound to tell your story. Now, the fourth one, which I've never heard anybody else talk about this, but this is me. This is my way of looking. The fourth one is staging. Because, and this is why staging, I talk about the power of staging. Staging is way more powerful than most people really understand because of some very basic things. Now, staging, just to define it, or blocking, whatever you want to call it, blocking is more of a theater term. Staging is more of a film term. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Pretty much the same thing. I'm talking about the movement of the characters in the space, in the environment they're in. I'm talking about characters in relationship, moving in relationship to each other. I'm talking about relationship to the room or the space. And even very specifically and very powerfully, a character's movement in relationship to him or herself, which is very simply body language, body language. Now, all of these movements communicate with the audience. If you have two people talking to each other, for instance, like this, and one turns away from the other, that's staging. Because we look at that and we go, ooh, what's going on? Something's going on. So even the most minute things, or even if you get into really micro staging, it can be a look that character. Now, maybe this choice of this look from one character to another was made in post-production, but that's staging. It's communication. It is a language. Now, there are two things about staging that are really essential. And from my perspective and my experience is I can take two actors in a room, say in an office, and they're doing a scene. They say it's an interview scene and someone's interviewing for a job or something like that. And I know that with these two people, I have two people and I have a space, which is just an office. There's nothing really extraordinary about the office. It's fine. It belongs to one guy and not to the young woman, we'll say. It's the boss and the young woman. But I know as I move these two, I just want to talk about the actors now. Forget the characters for a moment.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Where I start the scene, if I start that office interview with the boss sitting behind his desk and she walks in, and I walk in and I stage it, I say, walk in, and I walk her into a space where she is not near any furniture. She has no support. And I say, stop there. I just know that move will affect her, the actress, emotionally. She will feel unsupported. She'll feel insecure. Something. If I walk her in and have her sit on a chair in front of his desk, she'll have another emotional experience automatically. Now, the wonderful thing about actors, really good actors, is they will allow themselves to be open to whatever the staging is doing to them. So I can stage these two actors in a way to trigger emotions in both actors. If I start out the scene, she's going to walk in, but he's at the window looking out of the window. She's going to have a different emotional reaction when she sees him, and he'll feel differently. I can put him in positions of power. I can put him in positions where he'll lose power, all of that. So in other words, staging, when you're staging actors, remember, it's not just about the way it looks on the set or the way it looks on camera. And for the moment, I would say, forget the cameras for a moment. You got to make it work organically with these actors. That's when you're staging, remember that you are triggering, no matter what you do, anything you do, it's triggering an emotion within the actor. And what you want to do is trigger the emotion that the actor needs for the character. If you say to that young woman coming in for the interview, if you bring her in and sit her down in a chair, a nice chair in front of the office, and you say to her, how do you feel? She says, great, this is good. Now she's comfortable. And then you say to her, okay, let's do the scene. And remember, you're really uncomfortable. Well, now you're at cross purposes. Your staging has said, be comfortable. Your direction has said, be uncomfortable. It's better to put her in a place where she's uncomfortable. In fact, when I'm staging something, if I'm staging this young woman, I say, I come in here, just stand here. How do you feel about standing here away from all this furniture in this sort of no man's zone? And she says, oh, this doesn't feel good. I'll say, good. And many times the actor will go, got it. In other words, they understand, now this is an important part of staging. I can communicate with an actor what I want from the actor just by the way I stage them. But if I stage her to a point of comfort and I ask for discomfort, now she's getting mixed messages. And quite honestly, Alex, the actress may not know that she's getting mixed messages. She just knows she has to do one thing at that moment. She's feeling comfortable. I'm asking for discomfort. She's going to have to do something you don't want. She's going to have to act. She's going to have to pretend to be uncomfortable, find discomfort, go through a sense memory, whatever she's going to have to do. I'm trying to avoid that kind of acting, which you know from our other interview about directing the character rather than the actor, that I don't want her to act. What's really clear to me about characters and emotional states is that all of us are characters in our lives, and you and I are, Alex, right now, whatever's going on. And what we deal with as we go through our lives is we get hit by a lot of stimuli. We get hit by thoughts. We get hit by what we see, what we hear, what we taste, and we have emotional reactions. We see somebody that we didn't want to see and hope never to see again, and suddenly we're upset or angry or afraid. In other words, all this stimuli comes, and there's also stimuli from within us, our thoughts, our patterns. So we go through life having emotional reactions to our daily existence. And what we do is we deal with those emotional reactions as best as we can. When you see a person and suddenly, you know, it feels very romantic, and you go, oh my God, she's so gorgeous. You try to deal with that the best. Maybe you try to hold on to that. That's what we do. We do not go through life, very important, trying to stimulate emotional reactions. So when you say to the actress who's very comfortable, I want you to be uncomfortable, you know, remember you're very uncomfortable. Now she's going to have to stimulate something that she's genuinely not feeling at all. So there's this huge disconnect. So staging is a way not only of communicating to the actors what you want, but it's also triggering those emotions inside the actors. Now, as you do that, again, forget the cameras for a moment. As you do that and you watch it, or anybody watches it, now we're back to theater for a little bit. As the audience watches that, the audience, by projection, will respond as well. She comes into the office. She's standing in a very uncomfortable place. She's feeling uncomfortable. The audience goes, oh, my God, that's so uncomfortable, Wisha. In other words, the audience is now helping the audience help you connect with what's really going on. So you're actually, through the staging, not only communicating with the actors and then the characters, you're also communicating with the audience. Your staging is telling the audience exactly what's happening inside the characters. So it's a very powerful, that's why it becomes a language. It's a language between you and the actor, the character, and the audience. Staging is a language.
So what happens when an actor decides to go his or her own way in a scene where there's like an improv, or they seem to want to go somewhere else and it's not exactly what you either discussed, or, you know, it's a little bit more fluid. They want to act a little bit more fluid and not hit marks and do turns, and they just want to be more in the moment. And there are actors, obviously, who love to be in the moment, and we love that. Well, how do you, in this scenario, how would you deal with that?
Well, it gets very tricky. I mean, you have to, as an individual director, I'm talking to you, Alex, but anybody who's listening, you as a director have to decide for yourself with that project. We'll say, you know, project by project, this can change. How you want to handle that, how strict you want to be in terms of that kind of movement. And even in dialogue, if they want to improvise movements, are they also improvising dialogue? How loose you want this project to be, or this scene, how you want to do it. And I've done some projects where scenes are heavily improvised, but that's just that one scene in the movie. I felt with that scene, this is how I'm going to find something even better. So you have to decide. But getting back to what you're saying, the actor says, no, don't tell me where to go. Don't tell me what to do. I'll figure it out. Two things, and I'll tell you a quick story about the actor's studio, something that happened there. The one thing, all of us human beings, by instinct, we go through life doing two very simple things. We go through life seeking comfort and avoiding conflict. Mm-hmm. So an actor coming into a scene, by instinct of that being that person, this has nothing to do with acting. It has to do with that he or she is a human being, will seek comfort. They will go to a place on the set or the stage or in relationship to the other actors that feels good. And it will most often feel good to the actor. It has nothing to do with the character. So they will seek comfort and they will avoid conflict. Now, we're telling stories. And as you know, as a writer and director, what are most of our stories about? Discomfort and conflict. That's it. If you don't have discomfort and conflict, what do you have? You have a boring story. And you have, so all of us by instinct will do that. So you got to be aware of that. My job when I'm staging, and I will tell the actors this, when I'm staging a scene, I said, listen, my job as the director is to get your character into trouble. Your job as the actor, through the character, is to try to figure out how to get out. That's it. In other words, I'm going to create the conflict. I'm going to create the problems that the character is experiencing. You, through the character, try to work. Now, that gets us back closer to what real life is like. We go through life. We have a problem. We try to work our way out. I want to duplicate or represent as closely as I can authentic behavior. Not planned behavior, not planned emotions, not planned line readings and things like that. I want to create an environment where the actor, as the character, is working on instinct as the character. And one way to do that, literally, and I could show this, is to take away from the character the opportunity to just go wherever he wants. And people say, well, isn't that kind of controlling? Absolutely it is. But I'll tell you something else that's very controlling in this business.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Somebody wrote a lot of words that says this is what the character says. Now there's control right there. This is part of what we're doing. We got these lines. And now if you want to get down in the technical part, yeah, you got a camera here, you got lights there. You can't just go anywhere because you go to that corner, there's no light there. You know, it's the whole process is major control. But what I'm aiming for is that kind of major control. You got the dialogue and you got the staging. And but within that, which gets back to the interrogation process, total emotional freedom. I'm not going to tell the actor or require the actor respond emotionally in any way at any time. I want it to be on instinct at that moment, under the pressures of all of this control. So that's the dynamic I want to set up. But to go one step further with your question, if you want to go into this, or you have a, let me go back to what you said, you had this actor said, no, don't tell me where to go, don't tell me what to do, you know, give the actor a break, say, okay, let me see it. Let me see what you're going to do. Let me see. You may be surprised. You may go, oh, that's actually a little bit better than what I had. But then you got to lock it down a little bit. You can't say every take is going to be all over the place. You can't do that. So you got to give the actor the benefit of the doubt that they may have something, or you may end up, which often is the case, of a combination between what you were thinking and what the actor was thinking. And you find that middle ground, which is actually a richer collaboration combination of the two.
From my experience, I found that if you hire the right actors, they generally know the character much better than you do. They've done a lot more homework. Yeah. On the specific character and given this mm-hmm. character backstory and all sorts of things. So they might do a little bit of business that really adds a lot of value. And they might just do a movement or maybe just crossing the arms or crossing the legs or turning the body mm-hmm. or doing something adds so much to the scene that you might have not seen coming. So I always right. love to collaborate with the actors, but you're right. At a certain point, there has to be, okay, is this what we're doing? We got to lock that down. Okay, great. In this scene, let's talk about the scene and we'll talk about rehearsals in a little bit, but maybe in rehearsals, a lot of this was kind of worked out as well in that process. But my next question is, how does staging reveal subtext? Staging has a unique ability to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. I'm going to go back to the thing I talked about before, two people talking and one turns.
Mm-hmm.
One turns away from these two people talking and this. I'll have them turn towards the camera. This one turns towards the camera. So let's say these are two men talking to each other and they're brothers. We know that they're brothers and they're discussing what to do about dad. And this one says, well, I think we should put him in a home. This is what this one, we should have to put him in a retirement home. And this one just turns and says nothing. Mm-hmm. I just want to ask you, Alex, what does that mean?
Oh, it could mean a bunch of different things.
Now we're into subtext. Yeah. Now we're into subtext.
Yeah, just something as simple as a turn.
A turn. Yeah, and the subtext. I'm not saying what it means. What I'm doing is I'm creating an opportunity for you, the viewer, to start to project in what you think it means, even though the person sitting next to you might be thinking something different. Doesn't matter. I want to trigger the subtextual, open up that subtextual zone for the audience member to fill it in, which is an important part of storytelling or filmmaking, where we are triggering the audience to participate in the telling of the story, not just watch. And I think the most engaging films that any of us have ever seen are the ones that, for you or for me individually, where we have been able to participate a lot. It has triggered our emotion. It has triggered our projections. We feel like we have participated somehow in the telling of that story.
Yeah, without question. Without question. Now, one other thing about the staging process, if an actor has quirks or something that is very specific to them, should you include those in the staging? How would you include those in the staging?
The quirks like what? I mean, no. Let me ask you more specifically. Are you talking that the actor himself has these quirks, or the actor is, or is the the other part of my question was whether is this quirks he's developed for the character?
Both. It could be both. It could be something that he literally or she literally has in as a part of them, or that they develop the limp, the shake, whatever, you know, the handshake, whatever it is that they've developed. How do you incorporate that in the staging? Is there a way to do that?
Incorporate in the staging? Yeah, my first question would be, you said a limp or something like that. My first question would be for that character, let's say it's something that's created, it's not something that the actor has. How is that helping the story? How is that helping flesh out the character? How is that affecting the character? How is important that to the character we're trying to render? Well, that's really a conversation between you and the actor. Say, okay, you've got this limp. That's interesting. Here's what I think is going to, you know, it's, I mean, you do have the final decision, but even, you know, you have to have that conversation with the actor. What is your thinking here? It's not in the script. Could be an interesting idea. I don't want something in there that's going to create a black hole for the audience. They go, I don't get it. Why the limp? It's not going to be brought up in the script because, you know, is it just something that's there? And if you can make it somehow elemental to the character, you can make it somehow that it becomes an interesting part of the character. Then it's fascinating. It's not like The Usual Suspects where Kevin Spacey has that, you know, stream and that he shakes it off at the end. That's a whole.
Yeah, but you look at Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man. I mean, his whole movement is erratic because that's his character. Yeah. So he's doing his thing. He's walking. So he's autistic. So that will affect staging, like how, you know,
absolutely.
He's almost erratic. Yeah. So that's why that was kind of like the question.
Yeah. And then with something, I mean, the Rain Man thing is a good example. Your question, whether if you have this one character who has this erratic behavior, you as the director have to think, okay, how do the other characters respond to this? Are they aware of this? Does it bother them? Is it, you know, now in Rain Man, it was a big thing between Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman, those two characters, those brothers. You know, because he's dealing with this autistic brother, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it can't be just a quirk for the sake of, isn't that an interesting quirk? Because that it won't be an interesting quirk if it becomes a significant part of it. Now, the other part of what you are asking is if the actor himself has this quirk, and a lot of actors have quirks, which we've seen over and over and over again. And if it's a quirk that we're very accustomed to, I mean, for some reason, I'm thinking of Owen Wilson and facial expressions and, you know, things like that we've seen a million times. He's a great person to imitate, I guess, you know, say, do I want that? Do I want that? Or with a skilled actor, do I want to eliminate that? Do I want to, have him shift into a character who does not have the quirks he has?
It, like I was thinking of someone like Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood. His movements are so kind of through the wall kind of movements. He's very powerful. Yeah. He's very imposing with his movements. You know, and when he walks in a room, he just walks very differently than he did in Lincoln, let's say. It's extremely different.
Yeah, you're right.
So as a director, you're looking at that. I'm like, okay, so he's bringing this energy. And if it's Daniel Day, obviously this is a different conversation. You go, Mr. Lewis, how are you going to walk in the scene? Let's figure this out. How can we work it? But if you have an actor that's bringing that kind of energy to the scene, which is part of the character, that is the kind of question, like, how do we rework it? And there might be that erraticness around it. And the Rain Man and Tom Cruise situation is they're both very opposite. One's very erratic, and Tom Cruise generally is stoic, you know, controlled, everything. Yep. The only thing that knocks him off kilter is Raymond. Raymond's the one who does knock him off kilter and things like that. So it was just an interesting, just curious to see how we approach it. But I think we answered the question.
Yeah, but let me go back to There Will Be Blood and Daniel Day-Lewis. And you're right. I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis is a whole conversation by itself, but an actor who is taking on a behavior, a physical behavior like that, because they feel like, first of all, that probably empowers them to get into the, you know, you don't want to just take it away.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And I think for There Will Be Blood, that it was very appropriate for this character who basically was bulldozing his way through life and through everybody else and didn't care. So it sort of represented that. But think about, just as the director, you have to think about this character. Again, the same character, There Will Be Blood. Is that the way he always moves? Or do we see a moment when it drops away, a private moment? Can we see, in other words, what can you do in relationship to this moment, see a moment where he is vulnerable and he is alone and he is private, that we can see what I call the window of true nature. The window of true nature of a character is, who is he really? Is this a facade that he has developed that maybe over years, and he will always behave that way? But it'd be beautiful for a moment to see that when it falls away, when it doesn't serve him.
Yeah, the armor is off. The mask is off.
It's off. And then it becomes even more chilling, because we've seen something privately that Paul Dano and all the other characters in that movie have never seen. And we, the audience, get to see that.
Yeah, I mean, you look at a character like Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus, we're talking about two different energies. He shows the facade, but then his true nature comes out when he's literally eating a guard later on in the movie. But we see him as this beautifully poised, elegant, speaking, listening to music. But the moment he has an opportunity, the true nature comes out. And that's what that's really one of the most chilling parts about that character is that he puts on one face and we fall in love with a cannibal until you see him eat somebody else on stage and act erratically as a violent person.
Yeah, it's interesting that in the course that I'm doing now, the staging course, last week, speaking of Anthony Hopkins, last week we were looking at The Father. I don't know if you've seen The Father.
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it.
I highly recommend it. It's a man who's dealing with dementia.
Yes.
I'll give you... And his daughter is trying to bring in a caretaker to take care of him. So basically, so she could leave town. That's simple. And she has brought in a potential caretaker, and he knows exactly what she's doing and doesn't want it. And he meets the caretaker, and he's ebullient, and he's charming, and he's delightful, you know, and basically showing, I don't need any help. He goes off for a moment to get his watch. Now he's alone. He's coming back. And there's one moment, Alex, where he's coming back to talk to the caretaker and his daughter again. And he stops in the hallway. And he just stops. And all he does is stop. And you see, oh, my God, that's a moment. It's what I call an empty moment, a moment that you could project anything you want into it. Is it fear? Is it indecision? Is it, you know, what is going on? And then a moment later, bam, he's back in the room and he's entertaining. Now, that little moment is a moment of true nature. What's really going on with that character? And it's all done through staging. It's not in the dialogue. It's not probably in the script. I have the script. It doesn't say that he does that in the script. It says he comes back with the watch. But there's that moment, which he may, quite honestly, clearly, Anthony Hopkins may have just done on his own. Comes back and he stops. Just thinking. And maybe he's thinking about, how am I going to handle this problem? Maybe he's thinking, I'm in trouble. Maybe he's scared.
Maybe he forgot where he was a second.
Yes, exactly. All those maybes, which I go, what's going on? Are you okay? Are you okay? Then he comes back in and he seems fine, but there's the cover, the mask we were talking about, and there's the cover. So all done through staging. Staging is that powerful.
Now, what is microstaging? You said that earlier. Can you talk a little bit about microstaging?
Yeah, well, you're doing it right now. That was lovely.
That's acting, sir. That was acting. If anyone, you should watch the video, guys, to see my performance I just put on there with microstaging.
These are my terms: microstaging and macrostaging. Macrostaging, for a moment, is walk over to the desk, sit down. Those big moves. You know, and even in an action adventure, action thing, you know, this, I mean, a fight sequence is all macro, macro, macro. Micro staging can be this simple. Two people sitting at a table. This is why I say you're doing it now. And one person's talking to the, let's say it's a, at a restaurant, a cafe, let's say man and woman. Woman is talking to the man about something. Doesn't matter what it is right now. And the man is, I'll give you two scenarios, two stagings, both of them micro. The man is just sitting there listening and nodding.
Mm-hmm.
Or the man is looking down at his fork and moving it. Now, those two are totally different. That's a micro, the tiniest little movement. Or to take it one step further, the man's listening to her, right? And she's talking about people. We don't know who they are. And she mentions George. And on George, he looks down at the fork and picks it up. What does that say? That's micro staging. He has actually changed his behavior. That little shift there, again, it opens up that space that we go, something about George. What is it about George? She mentioned George, he shifted. If I just said to him as an actor, you know, when she says, George, just look down at the fork and pick it up. And he'll go, okay. Easy to do, very easy to do. Anybody can do it. You don't have to be a trained actor to do that. But that we see a shift in the character, and it can easily be something just in terms of eye movement. Yeah. Now, a lot of very skilled actors, you watch them. If you watch Anthony Hopkins, or you watch Meryl Streep, or Daniel Day-Lewis, or some of these people, Olivia Colman, you watch them. You watch for those little things that they're doing. Sometimes, maybe by plan, often just by instinct. Because they're so into the character, these tiny little, well, you want to make sure you capture that. And they went, those are micro stages. Those are the micro staging, more than the macro stagings, are the ones that allow us in deep inside the character.
That's, and it also reveals subtext when you do something like that.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So like the example of George with the fork, it's something simple. So simple and so small, but it says volumes. So if you're talking to me and I start yawning, that could either mean I'm just tired or I'm bored or I don't want to be here. So, and then you can insert what you want there. And it's just, and the eye movements and things like that. So a look is worth 1,000 words. And in movies, it's just, oh God.
I'll give you another example. Husband and wife in the kitchen. This isn't a real scene. I'm just making it up. Husband and wife in the kitchen. He's sitting at the kitchen table, maybe with some papers and stuff, whatever he's doing there. That's his independent activity. He's got, and they're talking. He's talking about his work, and she's at the sink with her back to him washing dishes. Very simple. And he's talking about work, and she's washing the dishes and washing the dishes. And he mentions his boss and a client. And then he mentions his secretary, Cheryl. On the word Cheryl, she stops washing. And he keeps talking. And maybe a moment later, she starts washing again, or she puts the plate down. That's micro staging. And that's subtext. And he's not looking at her, she's not looking at him, but it's a little piece of behavior. We expect when someone's doing an activity like washing the dishes, they'll just keep washing the dishes until they're done. Those independent activities are such powerful territory for staging that you can make a slight adjustment in it that it's powerful. This one that I just explained, I was in teaching in Munich. I remember this, and some actors were sitting at a table, were asking me about exactly what you're asking me about. So I had the two actors doing something. I gave one of them an independent activity, whatever she was doing, and the other one to improvise a monologue, but she had to get the name, I'll use George again, George in it. Mm-hmm. And I asked the first one, I said, when you hear the word George, Now, these are two actors. Hear the word your test. You're going to stop that activity, right? And hold and freeze until I release you and I say action again. So they did it. So this is totally improvised. These two actors, the one said George and the other one stopped.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I could see her, the one who stopped, started shaking, just shaking. And then I said, action. And she went back to it. And then 2 seconds later, she jumped out of her seat, went, oh my God. I said, what happened? She said, I don't know. She says, that was so powerful. In other words, that staging to her, she knew what she was going to do, but she had no idea how it was going to impact her. And the other one had a similar thing that she said, George, and she saw this reaction. So they, the two actors, responded emotionally to it.
Look at that.
That's how powerful it is.
And if you can capture it on camera, then
yeah,
you got money.
And the great thing, like what we're talking about, that independent activities and some of this micro stuff, they can do it again and again and again and again, take after take after take, exactly the same thing. And being skilled actors, they will allow the impact to happen every time. Just allow it. You could easily not have it happen, but you don't want to stop it from it. You want it to happen. You want that because that's part of what you're doing. That's part of the character and part of the moment. So it'll always work.
So now let's say you're in rehearsals and you're staging in rehearsals. The actors are working. We worked out these micro stages, worked out the macro stages. And we, you know, we kind of had an idea of what the scene's going to be like. Then we go on the day to location. And the location dropped out. We got this other new location that's completely different than what you've done. You've got 5 minutes, 10 minutes to restage this. What do you do?
Yep. First of all, in the initial rehearsal, you stage it for one location. But what you actually, hopefully, if it was staged well, you did explore and you found the essence of the scene and how the staging was helping you get to the essence of that scene and what's really going on between those characters. Now, the staging is helping you do that. That's what you have to rely on, is the essence of what you achieved. Now you look at the new location and you say, okay, actors, we have to change the staging, but we're staying with what we achieved. The relationship between the two of you, the sense of betrayal or the surprise at this moment, but we're going to have to restage it very quickly, still going for what we had, but in a new location. So it's not do the same staging. It's render the essence of the scene in a slightly different way, but still getting what the scene is really about, what the arc of the scene is, what the transformation in the scene is, what the shift in the relationship is, the core moment of the scene. You're still getting all that. You just have to do it a different way. And that's why I recommend to directors, when you're sitting down, even before rehearsal, figure out how you want to stage the scene three different ways. Three different ways in the same location. You have this location, it's the kitchen or whatever, three different ways. Doing it three dramatically different ways. I mean, and for instance, you can stage it in a way that, okay, this is going to take a long time to shoot because there's a lot of movement, but boy, I like it. Good. Stage it again where there's no movement, very little movement, where you're relying on micro staging more than macro staging. So if you get there and you only got 2 hours to shoot this scene, okay, I'm going to shift. I have to shift to something that's simpler. Or, as you've mentioned before, the actor comes up with an idea. If you have three different ways of doing it, they're going to come within one of those. You have all these options you can go to. And if you've done it in three different ways and they all seem like they're going to work for you, you have been hitting on the essence of the scene, what's really going on in the scene. The staging is not the scene. The staging reveals the scene. So,
got it.
So if you've done three different ways, it can be revealed. And you may get on the set and do the one you like the most and go, wait a minute, I got another idea. You may just shift because you're going, this is not working as well as I thought it was going to. Hopefully, because of my background in theater, I'm really advocating this. Hopefully you've had rehearsal time with the actors. And I don't mean rehearsal on the set, because that's really not rehearsal time. That's just you eating up production time.
It's very expensive rehearsal time.
Yeah, very. Yeah, you should not be rehearsing on the set. You should be reviewing what you did or clarifying what you're going to do, and that's it. Not exploring, oh, how am I going to stage this scene?
You need to do
that earlier.
Now, and the thing that I love about this technique is that you basically are able to adjust on the fly to whatever scenario comes from, because you have multiple ways to stage the scene,
right?
But they all reveal the essence of the scene in different ways. And if you can get the essence, then you could put it in a box, or you could put it in a very complicated location. It's still going to reveal the same thing. There might be the chess pieces will be moved a little bit, but the essence.
Exactly. Yes. That's what you have to capture. The essence of the scene.
Now, you've talked about in the past inner dialogue. Can you talk a little bit about inner dialogue, and how does that work or help non-verbal scenes? It seems that it's literally just two people looking at each other, or very Hitchcockian in that way. So what is inner dialogue, and how can that be used?
Well, inner dialogue is, first of all, it is, it's very important, because it is exactly what it sounds like. It's inner, and it is a dialogue. It's not, we don't usually just have thoughts. We usually have a dialogue. You know what I think I'll do? No, that's not a good idea. That's a dialogue. You've got two voices going on. You know, or you're looking at another character and another person. You go, I wonder what he's going to do. No, I don't think he's going to do that. That's actually you're having a dialogue with yourself. So it is a dialogue. It's not just thoughts. These inner dialogues are crucial, because number one, we as human beings have them all the time. We're doing it every day. Even, you know, moments before I met with you for this podcast, I'm going through I'm here alone at the moment, and I'm having a dialogue. It's preparation. It's what we do this all the time. So if we do this all the time, we have to assume, I have to assume characters, all our characters are doing this. The thing is, it's not written in the script what they're thinking. If the writer wanted to write that, they'd write a novel. This is not a novel. This is a screenplay. All we have is the spoken dialogue. The other aspect of this, which we talked about, I think, last time in 2017, is in our minds, all of us, we have what I call the committee, which is all the voices. The voices that talk to us, we talk to them, we work things out, they tell us what to do. Some of these voices represent people we know, mom and dad and neighbors or whatever. So there's this committee going on in our mind of discussing things. That committee is really crucial. Now we're getting back to the interrogation process, which we won't go into, but think about it, that every character has a committee. Every character is rich and thought process going on all the time. So if you have that scene that you're talking about where it's just two people sitting there, let's say it's in a bus station and the two people are sitting there across from each other, and they're both strangers, I will say, but they're going to meet eventually, but they're just staring at each other. And that's the scene. They're just looking at each other. Well, there's got to be a world going on inside each of them. There's got to be a major dialogue, major conversation inside each of them. And two things, what I do with working with actors is many times, and in fact, I did a film where you can see this, how this works. Many times I will have them before the scene, just before we're shooting, verbalize what's going on out loud. Two of them at the same time. They're not really talking to each other, but two of them just verbalize. They're saying what they're saying, and then they're just waiting to hear action. Action, and what happens on action is the verbalizing stops, but the thoughts keep going. In other words, I actually improvise and activate the inner dialogue. So it isn't like, oh, what should I be thinking about? I'm having them say it. And it's very powerful. They are saying it to the other person because the other person's in the room, but they're not saying it. That's not a dialogue between the other person. So they're exposing it. And the powerful thing about this way of working is those two guys sitting across from each other in the bus stop, they hear what the other person is thinking. Now they have a sense. Now they're And people say, oh, they shouldn't be hearing what they're thinking. I say, oh, yeah, they should, because what they're hearing is what they're thinking that the other person is thinking. I mean, I've got to connect these two people somehow. So the inner dialogue is a very, very powerful, very, very powerful tool.
And it's really interesting, too. Sometimes you can give two actors two different motivations without telling each other what that motivation is, which could be opposed to each other's, you know, goal of the scene.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And that makes the best scenes ever, because one actor is like, I mean, I use the direction once. It's like, I need you to, when you're yelling at this person, pretend you're trying to communicate to somebody in the other room. And it's not, so it, and that kind of gives you a level of where I want the volume to be without you going nuts. Good. Things like that, these little techniques that you can use along the way really help. Now, how can you create tension with staging?
Well, it almost does it all the time. One thing to think about, it's a good question. Staging, this is something I discovered years ago, and suddenly it occurred to me. When I was teaching, I would talk about obstacles, character obstacles. And I would say, okay, their obstacles are come in three categories. Other people are obstacles, okay? The environment can be an obstacle. Mm-hmm. You know, either the physical environment or the social environment, attitudes of whatever, society. And the third area is obstacles within yourself, you know, internal obstacles. So those are the categories of obstacles. And as I was teaching, I realized those three categories are the same categories as staging. You're staging people in relationship to each other, staging people in relationship to the environment, and in relationship to themselves, whether it's the body language or how they want to be seen or how they are seen. So that's, there's a very strong link between staging and obstacles. And I realized that what I'm doing with staging is I am creating obstacles constantly. Mm-hmm. Constantly. If an actor sits down and says, I'm going to sit in this chair, and I say, okay, sit there, but do me a favor, slide forward on the chair. He'll slide forward. No, a little bit further. A little bit. He says, I'm right near the edge. I say, good. I just created an obstacle. He says, this feels uncomfortable. I say, good. And he realizes I have created. Now, this is just in body language. He, you know, he's, first of all, it looks great because it looks like he is uncomfortable. I don't know why the character's sitting that way, but he is not comfortable within himself. And this has created an obstacle within the character, and it will actually trigger something in the other character when he sees him sitting that way, because the other actor as the character will also read that behavior.
Right.
And now we're now I'm creating tension. I'm creating tension within the body. I can create tension between two. Well, this has to do with the turning faces or stuff like that. Between two characters. What happens if I have this character move away from him? Now I'm going to create, while he's in the middle of that speech, that, you know, this one's planned this big speech and this one starts to move. I go, that's going to create tension. Or in the environment. Let's say we're in the office of the boss or something like that, and the young woman applying for the job walks behind the boss's desk. Well, there's a problem. You know, that's not where she's supposed to. We know that. We see the room. We know what the territory is. We know it's his space. And maybe he's gone off to the side to find a piece of paper or something, and she walked behind. Now I've created tension. I'm not only creating tension between the characters, but I'm creating tension with the audience. The audience will go, ooh, that's dangerous. What's going to happen? And I want that the audience to feel that. And it has nothing to do with the dialogue. Hopefully it's all supporting the dialogue, supporting the essence of the scene. But through the staging, I'm creating emotional responses in the actors, the characters, and the audience by creating tension and then relieving it when I want to. Yeah, so you can go, oh, okay, now we're fine.
Oops. Which, by the way, is an art, because there are movies that some of these more testosterone-ridden movies sometimes don't let go of the tension. They just hold you and hold you and hold you, where it becomes very unpleasant for the audience. I've had that experience a handful of times in watching a movie, that the director just wanted to keep it cranking and cranking. You're like, no, you've got to release the valve. You've got to release the valve a little bit. Even Hitchcock released the valve.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, he was a master of it.
Which, speaking of Hitchcock, how do you then create fear with staging? You know, in intimidation, power, that kind of the thing. Kind of like, and the first scene that comes into my head is The Godfather, where he's in that room stroking a cat. What an amazing. Mm-hmm. Which, after watching The Offer, which I tell everybody they should watch The Offer, the TV series about the making of The Godfather, mm-hmm. the cat. That wasn't masterful direction. He was just a cat that happened to be a stray cat.
He was a stray cat on the set.
On the set. Yeah.
And that's what I heard, that Coppola picked it up and gave it to Brando.
No, in the show, Brando picked it up. So he's either one. Okay. Who knows what the story is.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. But it was like, this will work. And it was a great cat. It was a great cat.
He just chilled and relaxed. He wasn't like going, because, you know, you don't want to include animals into a scenario where you don't have to.
Yeah.
But that scene is indicative of power. And there's also lighting mm-hmm. and presence. But how can you analyze that scene a little bit in the blocking of it as an example, or pick another scene if you like?
Yeah, no, that's a good scene. But your question was on fear.
Well, fear, power, and intimidation. I mean, he has all of those in that scene.
Right, right. And how do you create it?
Mm-hmm. With staging.
One thing. One thing is, which is part of a staging that is created there, is in the silences. Mm-hmm. You have the man across it. You know, my daughter, she was raped, I think, and I need justice. And then there's a long silence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we go, oh shit. You know, in other words, with silences. And then the cat helped with that too, because it's a gentleness against something. Right. And also in the editing of that scene, it's a long time before we see Brando. We see his hand, we see him from the back. It's a long, you know, we withhold that for a long time, but the silence is really a moment. Even in that scene, he says, you know, you come to me for this help, but when's the last time you showed me respect? Now that's just great writing. And you're going, you know, I said, this is not going to go well. And I think there's something beautiful about that scene, because at the end of the scene, he does say, I will help you and you owe me, because someday I will come to you. Maybe never, but someday I might. And actually he does in the story. The fear is going, working the scene as much as you can away from that ending, go in the opposite direction. So even in the staging, when Brando finally gets up and he walks around his desk towards the guy, now what's going to happen? There's also in the staging of that scene, but because I think Robert Duvall and James Caan are in that scene. Mm-hmm. And there's... early on in this scene, I think there's a shot. It's a great shot where Duvall is in the foreground. I think it's Duvall's in the foreground. And we can see Brando, the Godfather, in the background. It might be at the moment, I may be wrong about this, but it might be the moment that Brando is getting up.
Right.
He releases the cat and he starts to get up. Well, James Caan and Robert Duvall respond immediately. They start to rise and you go, whoa, there's power. You know, they rise because they don't know what he's going to do, but it's like the boss is moving.
I'm ready.
I'm ready. And where they're moving around, they're not going any place specific, but they're sort of positioning themselves to be ready. So it creates a tension in the whole room, which the guy asking for the favor has got to feel like everybody's moving. Is this good or is this bad? And that's what you want, to create that fear and to create that tension.
And that staging is so powerful, because you're absolutely right. Nobody knows who The Godfather is. This is now we all do, because it's a legendary film. But when in 1972, when people were watching it, nobody knew really what this meant. So just by that staging of he stands, the other two mm-hmm. stands, it says volumes about the power that this man wields, in addition to everything else that's going on the scene with the cat and the lighting and the performance and the dialogue. It all works, but that staging just adds this gravitas to this man, even more so than he already had. Not to mention it's Brando. They already brought his own gravitas.
And also, Alex, you're bringing up a great point, and I'm going to refer to Butch Cassidy in a similar way. That scene with Brando, you know, we got the Godfather.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
We got Brando playing the guy. I'm going back to before its release. And there were a lot of people didn't want Brando, but forget about that. But you were the director telling the story, and you're going to introduce this main character. And what do you need to establish besides the story? Your main thing is you need to establish this guy that we know by the end of the scene, we know who he is. This is your introduction to the audience of who this guy is. And it's actually beautifully done because it's, in a way, in terms of the whole story, it's a relatively insignificant scene, but it's very significant in terms of the introduction. So you've got to pull that off. The reason I said Butch Cassidy, William Goldman, when they were about to, the writer, not the director, William Goldman, when they were casting it and they had Paul Newman, who at that time was a major star. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about Robert Redford, which is basically unknown.
He was coming up.
But he wasn't at the level of Newman.
Not at all.
And a lot of people said, no, you got to get someone who's at the level of Newman. So William Goldman knew he had to write a scene, which he did, where he can establish Sundance Kid or Robert Redford at the same level and of respect as Newman in one scene at the beginning of the film. So from then on, they are equal. And that's the scene where Sundance Kid is playing cards, and he has accused someone else of cheating, or someone accused him of cheating. And Newman comes in and says, come on, we got to go. And he says, no, he has to apologize first. What? He has to apologize. What? He accused me of cheating. What? He has to apologize. Come on, we got to go. And then in that scene, the way it's written, Newman says, or Butch Cassidy says, Sundance, come on. And suddenly the room changes. People, Sundance? You're Sundance? I go, yeah, he's got to apologize. No, I'm not going to apologize. I've got to apologize. Sundance, and someone says to him, are you really that good? Which means with a gun. Are you really that good? In other words, now we're hearing about the legends about Sundance. And this is a famous scene. And maybe by this time, Sundance is standing up. And they, I don't know, someone says, can you shoot that, whatever, that bottle over there?
Right.
And he's just standing there. He says, just stay there. And he shoots and he misses.
Right.
And they go, oh, okay, he's not that good. Then Sundance says, a key line says, can I move? They go, what? Can I move? Well, yeah. So he starts moving. He actually starts moving a lot and shooting. And that bottle goes, and then he says, I'm better when I'm moving. And you go, hold. Now, that whole scene was so we go, who the hell is this guy's amazing. Bring him up to the level of Paul Newman. So when they walk out of that scene, they're at the same level. So it's the same thing as with The Godfather. How can we create a scene and create a moment to bring that recognition of a character to a certain level before we launch into the full movie?
And as you were saying that, the character that came into my head was Val Kilmer's Doc Holliday in Tombstone. In a similar way, if you don't know who Doc Holliday is, everyone's, when you hear the rumblings from others, how fast
he is.
And that he's a lungard. He's got, I forgot what's that thing called. They called him a lungard. I'm not sure if that's appropriate or not, but that was what they called him in the movie. And how he drinks all day, and even with all that stuff, he's still better than anybody else in the room.
It's
pretty remarkable. And the other character, which I haven't seen in recent years anyone do this, John Wick. My God, I mean, mm-hmm. the way they set that character up is so beautiful, because for the first part of the movie, you don't know what John Wick's capable of doing.
Right.
At all. And then only by the other characters' looks, microstagings, all these kind of things, like when he opens up the door, this is after he already showed a little bit of what he could do. When the cop opens the door, he's like, we heard a couple shots. You working again, John? And the cop, it's just so brilliant. But then like the biggest, baddest, you know, criminals, just hearing his voice is like hearing the boogeyman. You know, like, it's over. You're done now. The boogeyman's coming to get you. Death is coming. It's so fascinating. And it's such a brilliant. And look, they're holding it off to like episode fourth. The fourth one's coming out. And I think they can sign for 4 and 5. They're brilliant films. But that's a that's a really beautiful case of how the outside characters and environments really set up the main character.
Yeah, there's another similar situation, which I'd love to share with you, which has to do with As Good as It Gets.
Oh,
Jack Nicholson.
Yes,
Jack Nicholson. And that horrible character he has to play, the horrible human being, which almost everybody in the film calls him a horrible human being. But I had two friends of mine who were working on it, John Bailey, the cinematographer, and Richard Marks, the editor. And what I heard is that they'd finished the film and they had the first cut or whatever, and they did previews and everybody hated the film for two main reasons. One reason, they didn't understand what was wrong with this guy, why he was, they didn't understand his illness.
They didn't explain it?
You know what? I'll tell you what they did.
Okay.
They didn't understand his illness. Let's put it that way. His OCD at all. And the whole idea of him falling in love or anybody falling in love with him, forget it. So the whole, it was a disaster. So they went out and shot two more scenes. The one scene, in terms of what you're talking about, the OCD, the scene of him washing his hands with the Neutrogena soap and throwing the soap things away. Remember, he walks down the hall, goes in there. And so that was not originally. They had to show him the OCD right at the beginning. So you go, okay, he's got a problem. He's got a problem. So they shot that scene. And the reason it's shot the way it was shot, which John, the cinematographer, explained to me, he says, we only had that wall. That's the only wall we had, you know, because you're going back to do a reshoot. You don't want to put the whole apartment back together again. The other thing that they shot in terms of him falling in love, which was not in the original, was him walking the dog and the dog jumping over the cracks. Okay. The dog jumping over the cracks, which actually became the poster, this scene. And then him lifting up the dogs. He still has the little plastic gloves on and holding the dog and going, oh, yeah, yeah. Now, but a key thing about that scene was a shot to two women who are out in the park, wherever he is, seeing him and going, oh, isn't that sweet? That tells the audience what to think about Jack Nicholson. He is capable of being soft and loving and caring. It's told through two other characters that we don't even know who they are.
It's the old trope. If you want to show a villain, have him kick the dog. If you want him to be, if you want them to be loved, have him be nice to an animal or nice to a dog.
That's it.
It's as simple as that. It says everything you need to know about the character. And what I think I loved about that is that he did not like the dog, and it took a minute for him to figure out that he really did love him, to the point where when the dog had to go, he was like, but I could come by and see him, right? Like, he was completely transformed.
Yeah.
Such a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant script. Yeah. Oh, my God. That, and the characters.
I love the moment when he's trying to get the dog and Greg Kinnear to reconnect.
Right. The dog would be
And he's pointing to the dog. No, talk to him. Go look at him. No, don't come to me. It's beautiful.
He likes the bacon.
He likes the bacon.
It's not me.
Right.
It's such a tour de force. I mean, James L. Brooks is an absolute master. I mean, but look at that. And for people listening, someone like James L. Brooks didn't see that. He shot the whole movie. It happens all the time. And then he's like, they didn't like it. So like you had to add a couple things to make them likable.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's a great post-production story. And there are many like this, as you know, yeah. But the first thing is recognizing, okay, it's not working. What's missing? What's missing? What's missing? And how could we get it in? What can we do to take care of the element that's missing, or the clarify the element that's confusing? Because that's part of your job as a director. You're going to have to do that. This is why Woody Allen, now I don't know if he still does this, but years ago, because I have several friends of mine who were in Woody Allen films. First of all, he doesn't rehearse, and he doesn't think he's a good director of actors at all.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
He says, I don't know how to work with actors, but I do know how to cast. But that his budget, I think 25% of his budget was saved for reshoots. He would shoot the whole movie, go into post-production, put it together, and then he's got this chunk of money for reshoots. Now, that was his process. It's an expensive process, but that's what worked. Once he could see the movie and see how it was working, which is actually a luxury, to go back and say, I'm going to have to reshoot some stuff to make it work. That's a way to do it.
And I mean, the reason why, and people always asked, you know, about Woody and you know, his, I mean, he did a movie a year for 40 years, 30 years, something like that.
I know.
It's an unheard record, but he keeps his budget so low that he has complete freedom and then casts the biggest movie stars in the world who come to work for him for scale.
Yeah.
So it's good work if you could get it, sir.
Should we all be so lucky?
Exactly. He's Kubrick, but Kubrick only did a movie every 5-7 years. He did one single year.
Yeah.
Mark, I'm going to ask you a few questions to ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Well, there are two things. One is, because your question is trying to break into the business. That's, in fact, I would say, talk to Alex, my friend, because
there's a few podcasts that cover that topic.
There's a few, I'm sure there are. I mean, the whole thing of breaking into the business, getting into this world of filmmaking, getting into the system, the industry, the machine, whether it's at a studio level or a low budget, no budget level, it all has its challenges financially, artistically, and all that. It's huge. And I would say, you know, keep your expectations low. Make a film that you know you can make. In other words, don't push yourself. Make that film. Make that short film about two people in a restaurant or whatever. It's a short film. Make something that you know you can control, that can show what you are capable of doing, that you are capable of working with these actors. You're capable of getting these performances. If you wrote it, that you know how to write a screenplay. When I say keep your expectations low, which means keep your budget low, so that you're not pushing yourself to try to achieve something that is not within your budget. It's not within your time frame. It's not within your skill set. It's in your imagination. I got that. Keep it simple. Keep it simple. Some of the best films I've seen I've seen some great, are 5 or 8 minutes long. Mm. And they're astounding.
Mm. Powerful.
There's a short film, I don't know if you've seen it, Alex, called The Nail. You know,
I never saw it. Never seen it.
A couple sitting in a living room. In the whole scene, they don't move. They're just sitting. She's on a couch. He's on the chair near the couch. And we hear her talking about, you know, she's suffering from these pains, like headache pains and all that. And we see her from the back. We see him, and he's nodding. And suddenly she turns her head, and we see a nail protruding out of her forehead. Okay? A nail. No blood, just nail. And he goes, I think it must have something to do with the nail. No, it's not the nail. It's not the nail. And I go, And it's a whole, and it, but it gets into what it, what this story is really dealing with yeah. is men and women and how they deal with problems. And she keeps denying what he thinks he sees, and he keeps trying to help. It's really about male-female relationships, but it's really? All about the nail.
It's not the nail. It's not the nail. Put the nails in your head. It's not the nail. It's not the nail.
Forget the nail. You keep bringing up the nail. It's not. And I go... And it's a, I'm sure you can find it on YouTube. It's a brilliant, now whoever made this, it's a brilliant short movie. There's another one, which I can't remember the name of, which I love, which is outdoors. And a guy seems to fall out of the sky. He just falls. And then all this sound equipment falls down near him, which he picks up and he starts off towards a park. And we go over to the park and we see in the park that the people are there and an accident happens and someone gets badly hurt, really badly hurt. And this guy sees it and he's blasé, goes over, sets up all his sound equipment, sets up with a on a turntable, his that DJ.
Room. The DJ. Oh, that kind of sound equipment.
DJ equipment. Yeah, sets that all up. Starts playing. Starts playing it, and then he starts playing it backwards. And as he plays it backwards, the scene we saw reverses itself, and he runs it backwards to before the accident. And then he makes a couple of adjustments, and then he lets it run forward again, and the scene changes. And then there's another accident, and he goes, oh, God, okay, he runs it backwards. And now what he does, and finally he gets it so it everything's fine. Nobody got hurt. He's changed the course of events, packs up all his stuff. Then he sees a little girl down there holding her doll, which got mashed during the last thing. And he goes, oh, God. He puts the stuff back together again, and he cleans it up so her doll was not damaged. And there's no dialogue in the whole thing.
It's brilliant.
Brilliant. It's a brilliant. Now, there's someone showing, here's what I can do.
It's brilliant. It's a brilliant idea.
Follow your passion. Not your, just your passion as filmmaking. Follow your passion of what you want to talk about, what you want to explore. Like the nail, I want to explore the male-female relationship in a unique way. Do it. Keep it simple. Keep it simple.
Now, what are three of your favorite films of all time?
What's that?
Three favorite of films? Favorite films of all time. Right now, a today.
Lot. a lot of it, I'm probably like you. A lot of it depends on what I've seen recently. The Father, which I mentioned to you, is a stunning film.
Yeah, he got and nominated. He got nominated. Oh,
and
he won. He won. No, he won.
He
that
won.
One.
Yeah, he won.
Yeah.
He won. He won for the performance. But aside from that, it's a man suffering dementia. But the film is made in such a way that I defy you, Alex, or anybody else to be able to figure out what is actually going on during the film. But it's made so that besides watching a man suffering with his world changing and shifting and being illogical and confusing, the film, this is very dangerous, is also to the audience illogical and at times confusing. So that we, the audience, are feeling with our relationship with the film is his relationship with the world.
Wow.
It's brilliantly done. Okay. Talk about the power. And it's everything in it is so simple. The editing, the performances, the staging is all very sort of solid and simple. But it's to the point that the set keeps changing because the set keeps changing, which you won't notice, probably won't even notice the first time. But it's changed because to Anthony Hopkins' character, it's the world is shifting. So it's a brilliant film using cinematic storytelling in a whole different way. The Godfather, of course.
Obviously. One and two. You can put one and two in there together. That's fine. Because everyone always goes one or two. Like, put one and two together. It's one movie. So you have another one. Because they're both excellent.
Yeah, they're both excellent. There's Shawshank Redemption. There's Shakespeare in Love. He talks to you. We could go through genres and things. Get Out, which is a stunning film.
So many.
Yeah, there's so many. You can go on and on and on and on and on.
Well, mine's number one is Shawshank, and everybody here listening on the show knows that. Because I talk about Shawshank ad nauseum on this show over the years, and I've talked to story experts. I'm like, let's break down Shawshank. Why is this there? And what's the you know, the deeper levels of it. Why is this? Yeah. Why is it popular? Yeah. Why was it the worst title ever for a movie? Things like
yeah, that's right.
So
that's right.
Now, where can people find out more about you and the work you're doing?
Okay. The easiest way to get in touch with me, which is very simple. My name is Mark W. Travis, a W, middle initial. Don't forget that. MarkWTravis@gmail.com. That's it. You write to me. I'm talking to you all. You listen. I mean, you can write to me too, Alex, but you have already done that. That's how you can get in touch with me. And I invite your listeners to get any of them to get in touch with me. Do me a couple of favors. First, you get in touch with me, write me an email, mention this podcast. Mention so that I know and I can let Alex know, whatever. It's nice to know where you came from or how you got here. If you get in touch with me, I have some gifts for you.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I have a couple of videos that I will be happy to share with you. One is called Three Mistakes Directors Make When Working with Actors. Mm-hmm. And the other one is called The Power of Staging. So The Power of Staging is a longer video of talking about and showing exactly what we're talking about today. The other one is Working with Actors, Three Mistakes. I can share that with you. And for really, this is a dangerous thing, but I'm going to do it. For really serious, if you're really serious about a directing career, really serious, and Alex, you know what I mean about serious versus whatever else.
I want to be famous.
Yeah, I want to be famous. Right. If you're really serious and you can convince me, then I'm going to offer you a free half-hour consultation with me where I share with you all the things I do, how I can help you, how I can support you, and wherever you are in your career, wherever you want to go, whether you're just beginning or whether you're working professionally and you're running into challenges with working with actors or working with script or something, just write to me. Simple. Write me an email.
And you do have a website, don't you, sir?
I do have a website. My company is called Travis International Film Institute. The acronym is TIFFI, T-I-F-I, Travis International Film Institute. The website is so easy, T-I-F-I, TIFFI, .us, not com, .us. You go there, then the website, and you can see on there's a film on there that you can watch, which I'm going to send you. I don't know if I sent you the link.
You didn't send it to me.
Called Rehearsal Scene 22, where this documentary, you see how I work with actors using the interrogation process, which is what we talked about last time. It's all been documented, but that's on the website. You can see that.
Mark, it has been a pleasure talking to you, sir. Let's not wait five years to the next time, sir. You're a wealth of information, and hopefully this conversation has helped a few people with staging and some other things in their career. So I appreciate you, sir. Thank you again.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. It's good to see you.
I want to thank Mark so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe. Thank you, Mark. If you wanted to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/614. If you haven't already, please, please, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It truly, truly helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's I-N-D-I-E-F-I-L-M-H-U-S-T-L-E.com.